WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
For my whole life, and probably for yours, the word socialism has been often used as a form of slander in this country, a kind of rhetorical cudgel.
We are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country.
Obamacare and socialism.
Barack Obama is a socialist. He believes in redistributing wealth.
One day, as Norman Thomas said, we will awake to find that we have socialism. And if you don't do this, and if I don't do it, one of these days, you and I are going to spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free.
For some on the right, any social program that used tax dollars was big government. And big government was socialism. And socialism was Chairman Mao sending you to a re-education camp. That's the story. And now, what do you know? We have lawmakers in Washington who are proudly identifying themselves as socialists. Democratic socialists, and they're getting a lot of people's attention.
You can be in the private sector and be a democratically socialist business. Worker cooperatives are a perfect example of that. It's not about government takeover. It's about how much do workers have a say in your business? Mm-hmm. Do you have workers on the board?
When Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of the Bronx and Queens made her historic run for Congress recently, one of her biggest supporters was the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. Bernie Sanders' run in 2016 was also a watershed in American politics, and he describes himself as a Democratic Socialist. Jill Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard and a colleague at The New Yorker. She recently wrote about the long, complicated history of socialism in America. Jill, there are polls now that show that a lot of people, particularly young people, are very open to the idea of socialism, that this is not a degraded concept at all, as opposed to capitalism. What's going on now, and what do you think is behind this generational shift in thinking?
There are a number of things going on. One is, recall that the Cold War is over, and red scaring and red baiting just doesn't work as effectively as it once did. You can see that going on now, and it's not really getting a lot of traction. It just doesn't really hold for younger people who didn't grow up with the Cold War and don't associate socialism with communism. I think those terms have become uncoupled for a younger generation. Also, the disaffection with people on the left with the Democratic Party, especially younger people, is profound.
So, to borrow a phrase from the world of fiction, what are we talking about when we talk about socialism now? What does the word mean?
It actually doesn't mean anything. I mean, I think that is the problem, right? So, that one is people conflate socialism with social democracy, and I would say they no longer conflate socialism with communism. But the historical question. This is a sort of state of the field of American historical thinking. We don't ask what people are talking about when they talk about socialism. We ask this long, exhausted historical question, why is there no socialism in the United States, which was first posed in 1906 in that explicit way and has engaged generations of political historians ever since. And one of the things they always stumble over is, what does socialism even mean in the United States? And it does mean things different in the United States than it does in other parts of the world.
Well, how so?
So there are traditions in American political culture that other people would describe as socialistic tendencies that Americans have historically refused to call socialist. So we would say those are provisions of a social safety net. That phrase is used all the time. in the American political tradition, people who do use the term use it to represent, to invoke a sense of common weal, a sense of a shared social commitment to justice for all.
So three of the ideas that are currently animating the base of the Democratic Party, particularly on the left, are Medicare for all, a Green New Deal, and higher taxes on the wealthy, a lot higher taxes on the wealthy. Do you see there's a common thread between and among those proposals? And is it, in fact, socialism?
So Medicare for all and higher taxes on the wealthy have a long and august tradition in American history as policy proposals that actually have had a lot of bipartisan support. I don't think they are socialistic. I think they represent the kind of checks against kind of a heedless, reckless, unrestrained capitalism that we might be better off referring to as good government. We don't talk about good government anymore, but a lot of these proposals by people who've been brought into office historically have marched under the banner of good government.
But that somehow seems too centrist, too bland, to constitute a rallying cry.
Right.
So in Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, first and foremost, has championed a Green New Deal, and that calls for huge economic overhaul to combat climate change. When was the last time we've seen a proposal as sweeping as that?
I think that LBJ's Great Society constituted that scale. It had its own kind of utopianism. It had a similarly large role for the federal government. It was seen as an urgent response to a crisis that had not been solved by other means. I would say previous to that, the establishment of the national security state in 1948, 47, 49, around then, that wholly new apparatus for essentially prosecuting the Cold War and turning the federal government into a funder of university research and allying the government and the military in a new way would be a similar, you know, from the right intervention of such a scale that was defended on the grounds that everything else would fall short. And that's the defense of the scope of the Green New Deal, right? That nothing else has worked, right? There have been a lot of efforts to address climate change, and we're basically doing nothing.
Now, you've written about Eugene Debs in a recent issue of The New Yorker. The DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, can trace their lineage to this man. What was Debs' brand of socialism? And he ran for president five times.
Yeah, so I think Debs is actually best understood as essentially a lay Christian preacher rather than as a socialist. I think that his socialism drew on Christian theology. He wasn't himself a deeply pious or religious man, but the way that he and the people that promoted him presented him to the American public, which was a deeply Protestant public, was essentially as a Christ-like figure. He was a martyr to the cause. Going to prison twice was elemental to his story. Running for the fifth time for president from prison was what sort of wrote him into American myth. And there, of course, there's a lot. I mean, this is where liberation theology comes from. There is a lot in what the theory of socialism proposes that would seem to ally well with certain understandings of Christianity.
Well, what in the historical moment triggered Debs's embrace of socialism? What happened?
So Debs really started out as a big, you know, party guy. He was a Democrat, but he was a big advocate of the two-party system. Debs was a fireman who shoveled coal for the locomotive. And the railroad workers were incredibly hierarchically organized, and they were paid very differentially. And the more dangerous railway work became and the less responsive the railroad companies were to demands made by workers, the more radical Debs became. And he began to see not only that the brotherhoods needed to consider doing things like strikes, which Debs had long been opposed to, but they needed to form a union. So he formed the American Railway Union, which was a union of all the brotherhoods, in which all the different workers, no matter their rank within the railroad system, entered as equals. So Debs had this kind of vision of the profound equality of the railroad worker, and it is, in fact, that railway union that becomes the Socialist Party.
Now, Debs's background was not as somebody who's a young person who ran for Congress, but somebody who came up through the ranks of the union movement. Do you see any figures like that on the scene now?
I think that Elizabeth Warren wants to call on that. That is part of her campaign autobiography as a gambit, right?
But with respect to Harvard professors, Jill, she's a Harvard law professor.
Exactly. No, I mean, but I'm just saying, like, that's the closest I can get you to. I mean, there are more at the local level. But we live in a much more asymmetrical society culturally, I think, than Debs lived in. I guess I would draw
That's an interesting phrase. What does that mean, an asymmetrical society?
It was a piece of 19th century political mobility that someone like Debs could achieve the prominence that he achieved.
Meaning that if you go through the ranks of Congress, there are very few people coming out of the working class or a union movement or anything like that, and it's filled with millionaires, no?
Right.
Now, I'm not sure what Eugene Debs sounded like, but a young man named Bernie Sanders wrote and produced a documentary in 1979 about him. And in it, Sanders performed some of Debs's most famous speeches.
The little that I am, the little that I am hoping to be, I owe to the socialist movement. It has given me my ideas and ideals, my principles and convictions, and I would not exchange one of them for all of Rockefeller's blood-stained dollars. It has taught me how to serve, a lesson to me of priceless value. It has taught me the ecstasy in the handclasp of a comrade. It has enabled me to hold high communion with you and made it possible for me to take my place side by side with you in the great struggle for the better day.
To multiply myself. Bernie Sanders and Eugene Debs are different in many, many ways, of course, but how are they similar in their brand of politics?
I think their willingness to embrace socialism during a time when it wasn't popular to embrace socialism and when it came at a great cost, their willingness to be ostracized for that and to be on the margins of American politics. Sanders was involved in politics for a long time as a socialist mayor, really sensing himself as part of a long struggle. The basic policy positions that Debs and Sanders endorse, or for that matter, Ocasio-Cortez, are quite similar. There cannot be monopolies. There need to be higher taxes. There need to be workplace safety measures. We need to have a federal government that provides a safety net that can protect ordinary people from the ravages of unfettered capitalism. Also, Debs, like Sanders, did not understand socialism as a step toward communism, which is how many people understood socialism at the time and still do. And so in that sense are more social, better understood as social Democrats, right? Like they don't believe that the state should be making all the decisions, that there is a role for the free market.
Well, what's interesting to me is when Sanders gave a speech in the last go-around of the presidential campaign, right? I think it was 2014 or 15, he gave a speech about socialism. I mean, he would answer questions along the way, but he gave a speech about this. And when it came to the climactic moment and he talked about who his model was, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who always, always insisted that he was not a socialist and that he was a liberal. How does that square?
Yeah, I think we're back at the part of the conversation where the terms are unhelpful because the way our politics works is to discredit not the idea or the proposal, but the label.
Well, I guess so much so that at the State of the Union address, Trump gets up and basically tries to make the dividing line socialism. In other words, we are, meaning the Trump Republican Party, we are who we are, and the rest of them are socialists. That's the way he was trying to divide it up.
Right,
we will never be a socialist country.
That is the old move, right? Like that is the mid 20th century move, early 20th century move. I think what we're seeing is that kind of shakes loose in a different way. I mean, think about those 1930s of FDR, right? Remember when Wendell Willkie ran for president in 1940? He ran as a Republican. He was a liberal. He famously says, anyone who's not a socialist at the age of 20 has no heart. And anyone who's still a socialist at the age of 30 has no head. Mm-hmm. And that's how he defends himself from the charge. But he doesn't reject socialism. I mean, he gives this sort of famous speech in which he says, I am a liberal. Here's what liberalism means. And what it means is socialism. And that's why Bernie Sanders can point to FDR in that same way. The label becomes toxic, but the ideas carry forward.
And you've written recently that there is, quote, a certain timidity to the new socialism. What do you mean by that? Timid how?
I don't think the specific policy proposals, certainly the Green New Deal has some extraordinarily ambitious proposals, and I think many people find them to be ridiculously ambitious in that regard. But I'm not sure that structurally anyone is calling out what are some of our gravest problems, because I don't actually think that they call out the sort of data monopoly.
You mean the Facebook-Google problem?
The Facebook-Google-Amazon problem. I think that would be alienating to their younger supporters. I mean, that's why I guess just to return to sort of Deb starting out at the age of 14 working on a train for 50 cents a day and then coming to unionize workers who work for trains, there is no figure here who started out essentially indentured to Facebook and who has come to see that our problems lie with these massive data firms.
It's just so interesting to think of that, the idea that the next politically transformative figure would be someone who's a disaffected data worker at Facebook or Google.
But those corporations are our railroads, right? And the railroad and the internet are quite similar, right, structurally in very meaningful ways in terms of the degree to which the federal government gave the railroads a pass, like didn't tax them, gave them land for nothing. You know, like they just, here, you wanna transform the country? We're gonna help you do that. And that is essentially the pass that Amazon has from the federal government too. And maybe I'm missing it, but I don't see these people having that conversation. They wanna reach out to their voters on Facebook. They wanna tweet at them. They wanna send them their T-shirts by Amazon. And they want them to be excited about doing some social media event with them.
Jill Lepore, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
You can find Jill Lepore's article, Eugene V. Debs and the Endurance of Socialism, at newyorker.com. And Jill recently published A New History of the U.S., a terrific book called These Truths.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.